Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the challenges of homeland defense in the war against terrorism. Our guest is a law enforcement professional who has been writing and advising on this issue for some time. Jim Corey is vice president of the National Association of Chiefs of Police. He also currently serves as director of public safety at St. Peter's College in New Jersey. He served in several major law enforcement and public safety posts, including chief at a housing project in New York City's Washington Heights section. He is contributing editor for Chief of Police Magazine and Police Times, and is the author of two books, Crime Talk, Conversations with America's Top Crime Fighters, and Assume the Position, Police Science for Novelists. During this hour, we'll talk with Jim Corey about the role of law enforcement agencies and other institutions in defending against terrorism, especially in light of unspecified new threats. As we talk with Jim Corey, you are welcome to join us. You can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, and elsewhere in the U.S. via the Internet. Use our toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Questions and comments are welcome. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Jim Corey, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Let me ask you to begin by discussing the strain on police forces that we're currently experiencing. For an example, in Atlanta, already more than 370 vacancies out of 10,000 positions. And as elsewhere, officers are working 12-hour shifts since the attacks.
Oh, it's tremendous, the amount of stress on our nation's police departments. And it's not just major city police departments, it's police departments. You know, the average police department in this country is 10 officers. So even small townships find that their police departments are stressed, especially with the anthrax scare. The media covers some of the hoaxes, but there are a tremendous number out there. You have some individuals who are calling these in, or there's an overreaction to some powder found.
Right.
So just the anthrax scare alone has stressed out police departments. And you're right. You know, there's a lot of police officers who are working double shifts. We have to remember, life goes on also, and they have to deal with the everyday incidents that they've been dealing with all along.
Of course. You mentioned the anthrax scare, soaking up police resources with mostly little reason, would you say? I mean, obviously it's something we need to be concerned with, but if somebody is eating a powdered donut and then later they notice, you know, there's white powder on their chair, you know, they ought to put two and two together sometimes.
Well, there was one incident here in New Jersey where someone who was sorting the mail called a small town police department. They responded. They discovered it was the talcum powder from the gloves that the mail sorter was using to sort the mail.
Yeah.
And they have to respond to these reports. Because, for example, I mentioned New Jersey. In New Jersey, there has been actual anthrax discovered in postal facilities. So there has to be a response. And it doesn't matter where we're talking about in the country. Police have to investigate these things. There's an enormous number of tips coming in, a lot of them anonymous tips about terrorist activity or planning. By terrorists, and police have to look at these things. They have to investigate these things.
Well, let me ask you to talk a bit about that. Is there a way to sort of screen these calls? I mean, I'm sure that a lot of them are, or at least some of them have to be, you know, pranks or hoaxes or so forth. Do you have to respond to every single call, or how do you sort that out?
Well, I think that the calls have to be prioritized. In the event that it's an anthrax scare, they will routinely send two patrol officers to investigate. If it's discovered to be suspicious in nature, that's when the emergency personnel are called in. Same thing with bomb scares. You know, this country has had a drastic number of bomb scares. It's kind of slacked off, but in the first day since September 11th, in one major city, there were 120 bomb scares. So you couldn't have the bomb squad, you know, running around the city, you know, answering these calls. So what they did was they had, patrol officers, routine patrol officers, answer the call, look into it. If it became suspicious, that's when they would call in emergency services and the bomb squad to handle it. If it was unfounded, then, you know, they would just write up a brief report and that's it. Case closed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I haven't read about this, but I'm wondering, from your perspective, I'm sure you have a lot of sources that I don't. There are a lot of, you know, relatively wacko groups in the United States that have nothing to do with, you know, the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or anything.
Right.
And I'm wondering if maybe some of those are kind of taking advantage of the chaos to, you know, sort of like, you know, pursue their agendas or their own version of chaos.
Well, you have these right-wing extremist groups that basically hate the government. They look at the government as the enemy. We saw that in Oklahoma. If you recall, when that incident first occurred, the primary suspects were Middle Eastern terrorists, you know, Muslim
right.
terrorists. And it was discovered that these were homegrown terrorists who had a different agenda than the radical Islamics. So, you know, that is definitely a threat. Right now, we don't know exactly who's responsible for the anthrax, especially the strain that was circulated to the news organizations. I understand there was another victim in New York who worked in a hospital. She is now deceased.
Mm-hmm.
They can't figure out how she contracted the anthrax because tests of the hospital and of the area in which she worked came up negative. So, you know, it's something to be concerned about, but, you know, we have to find out who's doing it. We have to stop them.
Let me also ask you, I think there's a lot of discussion, certainly among the people who work in the media, about how to deal with the stories and the information that's coming out. And we're all concerned about feeding fears. At the same time, there is, you know, the media is incredibly competitive and everybody wants to, pursue the Pulitzer Prize, etc. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, do you think the media is handling things responsibly or are we also feeding fears?
No, I think overall the media is acting very responsibly. I mean, listen, they are fulfilling their duty to this country. They are out there informing Americans. The thing is that, you know, at the same time, and I've seen it, I've been watching the cable news stations, I've been listening to the radio, listening to NPR, you know, our own NPR affiliate here in the New York metropolitan area, and they are telling people that, you know, the chances of contracting anthrax, you have a greater chance of getting into a car accident than you do of contracting anthrax. So the message is out there. A lot of people, I think their fears are irrational, and I think we have to keep sending that message out. But overall, I think the media is handling this story with a lot of restraint. And will there be Pulitzer Prizes? Probably. You know, some of the coverage is extraordinary. You know, some of these cable channels, they have their people in Afghanistan. They have their people in Pakistan. Yeah. And, you know, I think they're doing an excellent job.
Yeah, good. Okay. Well, we started talking about the strain on police forces, and one other aspect of that strikes me as relevant. The call-up of military reservists might also hit police forces pretty hard. A lot of members of the police forces are also military reservists. Are we starting to see that be a factor?
Well, I know that in some locations, some jurisdictions where they have a problem with manpower, they're getting a deferment from the government so that they can, you know, maintain the number of police officers out there. And I could understand that because, you know, we are dealing with a two-front war. We're dealing with what's going on in Afghanistan, and we're dealing with terrorist attacks in our own country. So it would be ludicrous, in my opinion, to deplete the people who are on the front lines of these attacks in order to send them over to, you know, Afghanistan or wherever they're going to send them. So I know in San Francisco and New York and a number of localities, these police officers have been deferred, and they can continue to enforce the law locally.
Okay. We've had in the last couple of days, there have been some heightened alerts about, again, unspecified threats on American soil. And one of the questions that I've heard police in this area asking is, what does that mean? What is the heightened alert? How are we supposed to respond to that? What is the difference between high, higher, and highest alert? How are the police actually supposed to respond to that?
You know, that's a problem. And I'm hearing that from my colleagues as well. One colleague who is a chief of police in a major metropolitan area, you know, said he found out about the high alert while watching CNN. You know, that's not the way it's supposed to work. You know, and I think that the federal government, and you know, the director of the FBI had a meeting with police organizations, or the chiefs of police organization was one of them, the Sheriff's Association, you know, I think there were about 10 major law enforcement organizations who practically represent every police officer and commander in the country, and they had a meeting. It was termed more of a pep talk than really, you know, a meeting where intelligence was shared and direction was given. So a lot of police departments, they feel that they're on their own. You know, they get these alerts, and it's, you know, up to them to determine what steps they're going to take, what action they're going to take, what policies and procedures they're going to implement to deal with, you know, possible threats. I mean, we don't even know what the exact nature of the threat is, you know, the locality, the type of attack, you know. So, you know, police departments are basically on their own, and hopefully, you know, that there's going to be more intelligence sharing between the federal government, the federal law enforcement organizations, and state and local police organizations. Because it sounds great on television. We've just issued a high alert to all police departments throughout the country. They issued one to security directors for major corporations throughout the country. But, you know, what does that mean? What steps should we be taking? You know, and I think that they have to clarify that.
You mentioned information sharing among local, state, and federal law enforcement, and I think that a lot of people have regarded that as one of the biggest flaws in our system, that we have all these different agencies, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, military intelligence, each branch of the military with their own military intelligence, to use what people say is an oxymoron, and coordination, communication, cooperation become very difficult with all these players and, of course, you know, the local police departments.
Well, that's been a problem, and it was addressed in a number of studies that were conducted. You know, the last one was submitted to Congress in March of this year, and that was one of the primary problems that was indicated in the report. You know, it's as if, you know, they look at intelligence. The intelligence community looks at this information as if it's, you know, precious pearls, and they want to lock it in the safe, you know, and it's not disseminated to people who really should have access to it. Now, I can understand where, you know, the CIA and the NSA don't want to deal with local law enforcement, but the FBI is charged with counterterrorism. That's their function, or one of their functions. And they should be cooperating with local law enforcement as far as disseminating information. You know, the New York City Police Department, and I worked in New York, and I may sound biased, but the New York City Police Department has been successful on a number of occasions. There was one plot to blow up the Lincoln Tunnel, which connects New York City with New Jersey. And they found the terrorists out in Queens. They were Sudanese nationals out in Queens, New York. They did that on their own without any information from the FBI. They did that through their own intelligence sources. So I think there has to be a sharing. You know, a lot of local law enforcement officers and commanders are frustrated because they are channeling their information to the federal law enforcement officials, but there doesn't seem to be any feedback. There's no follow up. They're not being kept in the loop, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I'm sure that each of these different organizations have their own information systems that don't necessarily have a way of talking to each other.
Oh yeah, you know, we I've been saying, and so has our organization, that there should be, as part of any law enforcement organization, local or state, there should be a unit or at least an officer who's charged with the terrorism function, investigating and disseminating information. There should be a unit, for example, in the New York City Police Department. As it stands, even within police departments, there's a lack of communication. The New York City Police Department, a terrorist attack or terrorism comes under a number of different units within the same department. You're talking about a 30,000-member department. You have the bomb squad responsible for a certain area. You have arson and explosion unit. You have the intelligence unit. You have OCCB, Organized Crime Control Bureau, which, you know, under the New York City guidelines, terrorism comes under organized crime. So you have these units who are operating, and a lot of times they're not communicating with each other.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you also about the new Office of Homeland Security that is now a new cabinet-level position. Governor Tom Ridge, former governor of Pennsylvania, is the first director of Homeland Security in charge of that agency. And I'm sure it'll take a little while to get kind of ramped up and integrated with everything else that's going on. Do you see any movement in that direction?
Well, you know, I think that the media's got to give him a chance. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of criticism. Pundits have been making a lot of critical remarks about his lack of accessibility, that he wasn't doing enough press conferences. And now he was ordered by the White House. I guess he was brought up on the carpet, and he was ordered by the White House to at least have three press conferences a week. Now, I could understand, you know, I understand the nature of journalism. They want information, and they need the information in order to provide that to the public. But I think that, you know, we got a new guy who's just starting a job. You know, I don't think anyone even thought, did he move from Pennsylvania to Washington yet? Is his family with him yet?
Right.
You know, I mean, the guy started a new job overnight, and we're expecting miracles. This is going to take time. It's going to take time to get our intelligence community working properly. It's going to take time to train airport security, whether they nationalize it or whether they upgrade it at the local level. It's going to take time to train those people. It's not going to happen overnight. And the same thing with Homeland Security. He's dealing with a lot of different agencies, and you and I both know, because of the businesses that we're in, that you know, there's a lot of turf fighting going on in Washington, and there's a lot, I won't call it animosity, but there's a lot going on between these different agencies, and he's got to be able to coordinate their action as far as terrorism. So that's a difficult job. It's a difficult job if he wants to be more than just a showpiece. You know, the drug czar position, that was a showpiece. I liken this appointment to the drug czar. We expected a lot from the drug czar, and we got very little from that position. You know, I'm hoping that this will be more than just a showpiece position.
We're talking this morning during this hour, Focus 580, with Jim Corey. He's vice president of the National Association of Chiefs of Police. He is also director of public safety at St. Peter's College in New Jersey, and he's written widely on issues of law enforcement, counterterrorism, and when that's what we're talking about, homeland defense, the challenges ahead for the security forces and police and the other elements of society that are dealing with homeland security. If you have questions, you are welcome to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. I also want to ask you about the new law that was just passed and enacted by the president, toughening penalties and expanding provisions for wiretaps, search warrants, et cetera. Do you think that this is an appropriate measure to take? Is it enough to really give new and effective tools?
Oh, I think it is. You know, one of the things in fighting terrorism, and one of the reasons that we're a target for them, is because of our freedoms. These radicals in the Middle East hate us because of our freedom and what they call a decadence. But you know, we have a lot of civil liberties that are not enjoyed by other nations. And you know, when people talk, and I'm in law enforcement, so you know, you would think, oh, he wants this kind of, you know, I'm very careful. You know, I don't like giving up my civil liberties as a citizen. I don't like doing it. You know, the talk of creating, and it died down. They would talk about creating a national police department. Well, the police function is relegated to the state, so you know, right away, I'm against that. We don't need a national police department, you know. And as far as relaxing some of the restraints, you know, this is supposedly a war, and in wartime, you do have to make some concessions. The timeline I was a little uncomfortable with. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they had to have it for a 5-year period. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm hoping we're not going to be dealing with the Taliban and Al Qaeda for 5 years. You know, into the next presidential election. I'm hoping that it's not even going to be an issue in the next presidential election, that we'll be so successful at what we're doing. You know, overall, Americans have to expect some inconvenience. You know, security by its nature, whether it's national security or whether it's security at an airport or security in an office building, by its nature is inconvenient. A lot of Americans have a problem with it. You know, at the beginning, you know, they're going to say, "Yeah, whatever you have to do, do it." But after time goes on, they're going to find themselves inconvenienced. And Americans have the opinion that security is for the other guy. You got to screen the other guy. I'm okay. You know, screen him.
Right.
And you know,
doesn't work that way.
Right. You know, so overall, I think it's a good move. You know, I think that the Congress, I think they moved diligently with it. You know, some of the things that I was against are not in that bill, and I'm glad. The national ID card, I had a problem with that. You know, there were some things that I think a lot of law enforcement people had a problem with, even though it would make the job easier. But we have to think as law enforcement, we have to think as cops, and we have to think as citizens also. And what is right, and what, you know, just because it may work doesn't mean it's right.
We have several calls to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. Sure. We'll go first to a listener on a cell phone in Chrisman. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me okay? I'm questioning my connection.
Yeah, we hear you.
All right. You're talking about the security bill that's in Congress now, and I'm wondering, has a decision been made of whether that's going to be federal or privatized security at the airport?
Ah.
Right now, it's still being debated, and it goes across party lines. Apparently, the Republicans are against federalization, and that means having federal employees as security officers or screeners or whatever you want to call them. And the Democrats want to have federal employees working security at our airports. My opinion is that it should be a hybrid system. The federal government oversight, for example, have supervisory personnel who work directly for the government, responsible at the different airports for overall security. You know, like we have a Homeland Security Director, have an Airport Security Director, and still use private security. And there's a number of reasons why I favor that. Number one, we have to bring up the salaries. You know, you can't have a guy making $6 an hour and no health care benefits, you know, dealing with a really sensitive area at any facility, whether it's an airport or college or, you know, an office building. But, you know, if for example, and we saw this, there was a man who got onto an airplane with a handgun, concealed weapon, who got through a screener. The screener was terminated immediately. After they spoke to him, they terminated him. If it's a federal employee, you're going to have a hard time doing this. Mm. It's a civil service position. You know, and I'm not denigrating federal employees, But sometimes, you know, in the private sector, I know a lot of people in the private sector will tell you they are very hesitant when they have an applicant who comes from the public sector, because they think in different terms. You know, they're looking at job security, they're looking at their compensation package, and you know, we have to be realistic about it. So that's the way I think they should approach it. You know, a hybrid department where you have the top guys working directly for the federal government, not union employees. These are management positions, and then you use the private security sector. Whether they hire their own people, you know, at the airport, individual airports can hire their own people. Let's call a proprietary system, or a contract system where you go to an outside firm and contract for security officers.
You know, I'm going to disagree with you on that, because I feel like on September 11th, our commercial airlines were used as weapons, and I think that puts it square in the lap of the federal government to put, and I'm not talking about federal employees, I'm talking about military personnel should be doing that.
Mm.
I think we should have Marines at our airport. I think there should be a Marine on every airplane that flies.
There's a problem with that, using the military internally. That's why we have National Guard forces. What we're seeing, for example, at JFK International Airport in New York, there are National Guard soldiers there, but it's a temporary thing. These guys, you know, it's a part-time job, basically. They called out the National Guard, so these guys, they leave their jobs, they leave their families, and they go and they take care of business.
I think that's
going to be a long-term thing. And, you know, I have a problem with using military people as police officers. I really do.
We're
trying to get away from the idea of police in this country being a paramilitary force. It got us into a lot of trouble in the 90s. You know, they have to be looked at as public servants, people who are providing protection of life and property within the community, people who have a stake in the community. And I have a problem with using outside military people for the police function.
Well, I think that a lot of people in the military would agree with that. That's not their role, as you know, that they'd be willing to serve if asked to. But, you know, that's what the police are for, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah. We have a couple of the callers. We're a little past our midpoint. Let me just mention again, our guest is Jim Corey. He's vice president of the National Association of Chiefs of Police. And we're talking about homeland defense and a variety of issues that pertain. We do have a couple lines open and about maybe 20 minutes left. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 333-9455. That's around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We have someone in Taylorville next on line number. Oh, I'm afraid we lost that person. Sorry about that. Made them wait a while. Line number three is next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. I just like to reiterate part of the last gentleman's call. I kind of agree with him. I think those baggage screeners, handlers, and personnel people at airports should be military. Number one, they would be federal employees. Number two, they wouldn't cost us an arm and a leg. And number three, if they screw up, they're going to get court-martialed and do hard time, and they're going to know it, and that there's going to be serious punishment. What are we going to do to somebody that's making $30 an hour, has got a ho-hum attitude about their job, which a lot of federal employees do, and, you know, and the same thing happens. You know, their union will go to bat for them, and they'll say, oh, well, poor guy, he just has some excuse for him, you know. As for federal oversight or private, well, the FAA's been in charge, and they haven't done too cool a job as it is. So I really think that, you know, I wouldn't want to see the military in every facet of police life, but I think that this is a place where they could certainly be utilized. They would be up front. When people come through the airport, they would not only, I think, be reassured to see them there, but bad guys would think twice, too.
Well, Mr. Corey, what do you think?
Well, you know, it sounds great to have the military, and it sounds great because people will feel better. You know, when the National Guard marched into JFK International Airport, and then they supplemented them with U.S. Coast Guard, they were cheered.
Yeah.
When they started marching into Grand Central train station in the heart of Manhattan, they were being cheered. But basically they're there for a showpiece. They're not really doing anything. Again, they're not trained. I am for professional security officers, whether they're private sector or federal government, who are trained. If you look, we've all traveled and we've all come into the airports. We have to go past customs. You know, customs agents, and we call it a gut feeling, but they're trained in criminal profiling. They're looking for body language. They're looking for suspicious behavior. How many times have we heard that they just pick someone out of a crowd, they search their belongings, and they confiscate contraband?
Right.
So, why can't we have that type of individual at the other end of the airport on departures? I have a big problem with using the military in the police function within our own borders. I don't want us to we have to watch out. We don't want an armed camp here. We don't want to look like a third world country. I do not want to walk the streets of Manhattan looking at people carrying semi-automatic firearms, marching around the city, tanks going up and down the block. That just does not appeal to me.
We have another caller to talk with in Champaign on line number one next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. I called in without maybe organizing my thoughts as well as I should have, but I'm really concerned about these people who want the United States military patrolling the streets and airports and everything else. I mean, we have emergencies that call for extreme measures, but this, as a permanent policy, really makes me uncomfortable, and I think these people aren't even listening. And I think we have to remember it's been 30 years since large percentages of the population have been in the military or even know somebody who's in the military. They're trained, as fall back on the old saw, to kill people and break things, and they're not supposed to do it to us. And it really concerns me that people are so eager to have our soldiers standing around with guns. I've lived in places where the Army does that, and it's not fun. And there seems to be this idea that you have a soldier with a machine gun or you have a minimum wage know-nothing. And, there's some room in between there to find people who can do these jobs and can be trained. And I don't think it's horrible for that to be a career, something that somebody can get that job and support their family doing and have a stake in doing a good job and staying there. And as your guest pointed out, there are ways for the private sector to cooperate with the federal government or the state government or however they want to do it. But, I hope people will ratchet it down a little bit and really think carefully before they make a great hue and cry to get the military standing all over this country with guns. That really concerns me that people are so eager to have that happen. And I hope there's at least something you can address if I didn't come up with an actual question. But I guess partly I call because not everybody agrees with these people who want the Army in the streets yesterday.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you. I agree 100% with that caller. We have to, when we're talking about security at airports and security at court, I'm a believer in the marketplace and a free marketplace. And if there are standards, for example, you can't low bid, you can't get security on the cheap, if there are standards, you can, attract the caliber of person that you want working in private security. It's a matter of compensation. Whether it's federal employees or private security, there has to be a standard for pay scales. There has to be a standard for compensation packages for them. I think with the airlines, for example, I've calmed down a bit. I was really angry when I found out that some of these airlines pay their CEOs well over $12 million a year, and their parachutes, if they lose their job, are just unbelievable as far as compensation. And yet they, one of the most sensitive areas in airlines, and that's security. They were going on the cheap as far as security personnel, $6, $6.50 an hour. A man cannot support a family, or a woman cannot support her family with $6.50 an hour. What's going to happen is they're going to work a lot of double shifts just to try to make ends meet. And you have someone who's on their feet 16 hours, you can't tell me that person's paying attention to what's going on around him or her.
Sure. Well, you mentioned standards, and I think the standard before was whatever the market will bear. And so that what we had is airlines hiring security firms based on the lowest bidder.
Right.
And we saw what we got from that. How do you raise the standards? Is there some, you know, law or some way that, you know, we can sort of mandate that?
Well, you know, you're right. As far as airports, yeah, there have to be laws. There have to be national standards so that all there's uniformity among the different airports throughout this country. As far as pay, as far as training, as far as in-service, you know, just because someone goes to a security academy or a police academy doesn't mean that they're going to carry that throughout their career. You have to have refresher courses. So these have to be included as far as standards. And we have to eliminate this low bid activity that we're seeing throughout the industry. You know, one of the things I'm not seeing is talk about the security industry as it stands. You know, it depends on what part of the country you're in as far as these security agencies. Some agencies have to have a business license. That means that they don't have to have a professional license, so anybody can open an agency. And what I've seen here in the New York metropolitan area, a man owns or a woman owns a cleaning company, and they find out that security is very lucrative. Okay, what they do is they open up a security branch of their cleaning service. They have no background in law enforcement, no background in security. Where you do have licensing requirements, like I said, it's usually a business license. In some states, there's no requirement for background checks on security, prospective security officers. You don't have to fingerprint them. You don't have to check to see if they have a criminal record. Where you do have screening, it takes up to 3 months to get the fingerprints back from the FBI and the state law enforcement service. So, you know, you've got a guy who could be working at your site who has ties to terrorists working for 3 months before you even know about his record. And even then, you know, he may not have a record. You know, these guys that on September 11th, they had clean records. They had, they had their visitors' visas. They had the okay to go to flight schools within our own country. You know, there have to be standards throughout the country, I think, for the entire security industry. For too long, the government looked the other way while these fly-by-night companies, you know, they packaged their product with fantastic brochures. They may hire a former FBI director or FBI supervisor or Secret Service guy and put him as the front man, the salesman. But the person you're getting on your site, whether it's a college or a business or an airport, the person you're getting on your site is not trained, doesn't know anything about security, and definitely doesn't know anything about counterterrorism.
We have a couple callers to talk with. Let's go next to someone on the campus here of the University of Illinois on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. In all of these discussions, anytime it's brought up to federalize the security at airports, somehow state and federal workers always get lambasted, and I'm really sick of it. There are plenty of serious, honest people working for the state and federal government. One of the biggest problems with doing that is that the management decisions are always based on politics and corruption rather than what they ought to be, which is good decisions. And I also want to point out that I believe this idea that they can't be fired, if we make them, the security people at airports, federal employees, they can't be fired, so therefore we can't do it. Well, aren't FBI agents and CIA agents federal employees and customs agents, which you just regaled as really great, aren't they federal employees? Now, CIA agents, if they turn out to be counter spies, they're put in jail. That's beyond just being fired. And I would think that they would have to have security clearances and all the other things that FBI and CIA agents would have. So I really don't understand these arguments.
Well, Mr. Corey, what do you think?
Well, the CIA and FBI agents are a class of federal employee called expected service. In other words, they're not part of civil service. And they, you know, like you said, they could be terminated for an infraction. It doesn't have to be treason or spying. But the Congress and members of Congress are concerned about is that you're going to have a class of employee that's going to be below FBI and CIA. I'm sure they're looking at the dollar amounts, the pay scale for these employees
How much did what happened cost us? How can you say that it's going to be too expensive to do this? Look what this has cost. We don't even know
that.
What it's going to cost.
I'm telling you what politicians that I know are saying. You know, they look at cost, you know. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with that. I don't agree with law enforcement agencies having to look at cost for some function that they want to perform. But that's the nature of the beast, you know. You have, for example, you know, everyone's saying, you know, people who are expounding the idea of using federal employees. You know, the FAA conducts vulnerability tests over the years. For airports across the country, up to 70% of the time they were able to breach security. Why didn't they take any action?
Yeah,
then?
Yeah.
You know, why do we wait till September 11th? They already knew. You know, same thing with the atomic power plants. You know, they have done vulnerability tests. They used Navy SEALs to see if they can, special forces guys, to see if they could breach the security systems at these facilities. And they did. They did 100% of the time, you know. And yet, you know, why do we wait until something like this occurs to start talking about what we should do? This should have been done a long time ago. You know, even the experts who we're seeing now, you know, the talking heads that came out of the woodwork after this incident, they said it wasn't a matter of could it happen or would it happen. It was a matter of when it would happen. So it's not like this, you know, we're shocked, you know, but I don't think we should be very surprised.
Mm-hmm. Let me just take a moment to observe, and it may seem, it may seem inadequate, but it is still true that anyone who feels that we ought to federalize airport security or ought not to, whatever your view, you should definitely make that view known to your member of Congress and your senator, because now is the time when those decisions are being made. So. That would be an appropriate response, certainly on the part of anyone who really cares about these.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, and whichever way we go, we have to make it as efficient as possible. You know, we can't allow the government, whether it's state or local or federal government, to put some pinhead in charge who's a bureaucrat and has no idea of security and no idea of law enforcement You know, hopefully it won't be a politicized position.
Very good. We have another caller. We'll include them, and we have just about 5 minutes left, so we'll have to try to be brief. Someone on line number 4 in Aurora. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, I appreciate this talking. One thing that I wanted to make a point of is that the air industry has really been doing us a great disservice in charging outlandish prices for their services so they can pay the CEOs a lot of money. And I think that has been found out. This point that you're speaking to now, then will Congress decide it? Is that who will decide who we're going to have at the airports?
Apparently that's what's going to happen. Congress will decide, and it'll be up to the president to either veto or sign the bill, whatever comes out of Congress. I think that's the nature of the beast. You know, there's going to be compromise, and I think it will be a hybrid approach, which, you know, I advocate personally, a hybrid approach. I'd like to see people from the private sector, maintain these jobs at a reasonable salary and benefits and a complete compensation package under the oversight of the federal government. There should be one office that handles it. You know, it shouldn't be just part. You know, the Sky Marshal program, that's been around for years. Originally, the FAA had it. They didn't want it, so they turned it over to the U.S. Marshal Service. And the U.S. Marshal Service really didn't want it. You know, they wanted to spend their money on other areas. And what happened was you had like a handful of Sky Marshals left through attrition. And then we find out we got to train a whole new batch of Sky Marshals, which is going on right now. So, you know, there has to be somebody that we can go to and say, hey, what's going on? How come you're breaching security at our airports and nothing's being done? How come, you know, the security officers at this airport are fast asleep during the midnight shift, which happened in JFK Airport, mm-hmm. by the way. The New York Times broke that story a few years back. They were all sleeping. People were going by the machines. They're ringing like crazy, and nobody's paying attention. So, I mean, you know, we have to professionalize it. You know, it's been a joke for years.
We just have 2 minutes left, and there are many things we could talk about, but I want to ask you one slightly different question. You suggested that we should try to understand the reasons people turn to terrorism. You've written, an astute American foreign policy must take into account the reasons people turn to terror and, where appropriate and feasible, address them. To some people, that sounds like accommodation, and I think that we're undergoing a debate about that right now. But I guess, how do we find a balance?
Well, I didn't say you have to have compassion for them or
right.
you know, try to learn how you can get along with them or like them. But it's necessary to understand them. You know, that's a basis for dealing with criminals or dealing with terrorists. You know, understanding what makes them tick. That helps you with creating a strategy for dealing with them. I think we were very naive, law enforcement and private citizens were very naive about the enemy, you know, in this war. For too long, we thought that they thought the same way we did, and they don't. They don't. They have a different agenda. They have a different thought process than we do. And, you know, we have to understand the enemy. That's basically what I meant.
Okay. Well, we're here at the point we're going to have to stop, and I can only suggest we'll continue talking about this subject. And if you'd like to read more of the thoughts of our guest, Jim Corey, he's vice president of the National Association of Chiefs of Police, and he's got a couple of books, one, Crime Talk, Conversations with America's Top Crime Fighters, and a new book out for novelists entitled Assume the Position, Police Science for Novelists. And to you, Jim Corey, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right.